ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
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 ओम ज्ञानतिमिरांधस्य ज्ञानांजनशलाकाय चक्षुरोन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नमः ॐ विष्णुपादाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्तस्वामिनिति नामिने। नमस्ते सारस्वते देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषशून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे। हरे कृष्ण। सो वेलकम एवरीवन to the second day of the seminar. Can we turn the mic down just a little bit? It has a little bit of an echo. yeah, so welcome. Thank you, that's perfect. So, to the second day of this seminar. And last time, yesterday, we gave an overview of Bhagavad Gita and set the stage for discussing the four essential verses that we're going to talk about today. And these four essential verses, chapter 10, text numbers 8, 9, 10, and 11. So we just read those verses briefly last time, but the whole idea was to see how the Bhagavad Gita builds up to these verses. What are the different changes and shifts in conversation that take place so that Arjuna is now ready to hear these four important verses. Right? And the step just before this was that Krishna had begun chapter 10 by saying, now you should hear my supreme instructions. Shrinu me paramam vacha, he says. My supreme instruction. Something that he repeats, he says again, only at the end of Bhagavad Gita. He says, listen to my supreme instruction. So we can, you know, the end of the Bhagavad Gita, obviously Krishna is repeating the most important things. But the first time he says those, are here in chapter 10, text number 8 through 11. So we can sort of see they're quite important verses. Now, the plan is that we're going to start off with the first verse now, text number 8, perhaps moving into 9, for the session from 2 to 4. And then for the later session, we'll do a little bit more, but the primary task will be a workshop-type activity, which I'll delineate later, where we'll get a chance to sort of try our own hand at understanding the essence of Bhagavad Gita and coming up with some things ourselves. So hopefully it should be interesting, educational, and also a bit fun. So let's read text number 8 again. Okay. And if you don't have Bhagavad Gita, that's okay. For this session, you don't need it. But if you know the verse, you can repeat after me. Aham sarvasya prabhavo.
Aham sarvasya prabhavo.
Matta sarvam pravartate.
Matta sarvam pravartate.
Iti matva bhajante mam.
Iti matva bhajante mam.
Buddha bhava samanvita.
Buddha bhava samanvita.
Translation, purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. So let's read this again responsively so we can think about each part of this verse here. So please repeat. I am the source.
I am the source
of all spiritual and material worlds.
Everything emanates from me.
The wise who perfectly know this,
engage in my devotional service,
and worship me with all their hearts. Purport. A learned scholar who has studied the Vedas perfectly and has information from authorities like Lord Chaitanya, and who knows how to apply these teachings, can understand that Krishna is the origin of everything in both the material and spiritual worlds. And because he knows this perfectly, he becomes firmly fixed in the devotional service of the Supreme Lord. He can never be deviated by any amount of nonsensical commentaries or by fools. All Vedic literature agrees that Krishna is the source of Brahma, Shiva, and all other demigods. In the Atharva Veda, Gopal Tapani Upanishad, it is said, Yo Brahmanam Vedadhati Purvam, Yo Vai Vedang Shagapayanti Sma Krishna. It was Krishna in the beginning who instructed Brahma and Vedic knowledge and who disseminated Vedic with knowledge in the past. Then again, the Narayana Upanishad says, Atha Purusho Havai Narayano Kamayata Prajasrijayeti. Then the Supreme Personality of Godhead Narayan desired to create living entities. The Upanishad continues, Narayanad Brahma Jayate, Narayanad Prajapati Prajayate, Narayanad Indro Jayate, Narayanad Ashto Vasavo Jayante, Narayanad Ekadasharudra Jayante, Narayanad Dvadashadityah. From Narayana, Brahma is born, and from Narayana, the patriarchs are also born. From Narayana, Indra is born. From Narayana, the 8 Vasus are born. From Narayana, the 11 Rudras are born. From Narayana, the 12 Adityas are born. This Narayana is an expansion of Krishna. So, Krishna begins these essential teachings with a very clear statement about himself. Aham sarvasya prabhava, matta sarvam pravartate. I am the origin of everything. Prabhava means the source. Matta sarvam pravartate. And everything turns, it comes out, it churns out from me, pravartate. Which is basically a repetition. Krishna is saying the same thing in 2 different ways in this first verse. I am the source of everything, and everything comes from me. Which is 2 ways of saying the same thing. So Krishna is being very emphatic here. In a classroom situation, if a teacher repeats something more than once, then students usually know, okay, this is something worth taking note of. It's probably important. And so Krishna is repeating himself in this verse in slightly different language. He says, I'm the source of everything, and everything comes from me. He starts off with this very self-centered statement. Self-centered. Krishna is talking about himself. Now, typically, being self-centered is considered a bad quality in this world, considered a negative thing. If someone's self-centered or narcissistic or they're full of themselves, we say, and that's not considered a good thing. It's considered to be selfish. Your world is small, you're arrogant, you're proud. But we find that in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, in every chapter, right from the beginning, he's repeatedly talking about himself. And as the Gita progresses, the volume, the intensity with which Krishna is talking about himself gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Like that verse at the end of the 9th chapter. Manmana bhava mad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru mam evaishasi satyam te pratijane priyosi me. This one is at the end of the 18th chapter. But there, think of that verse. Krishna says, think of me, become my devotee, offer your homage unto me. All these things. How many times in that one verse Krishna repeats the word me? Okay? Man mana. Man means me. Bhava mad bhakto. Become my devotee. Madhyaji. Worship me. Mam namaskuru. Offer obeisance to me. Mam evaishyasi. You'll come to me. Satyam te. In truth. Pratijane priyosi me, because you are very dear to me. 6 times in the same sentence, Krishna said, me, 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 me. And normally we think, oh, that's terrible. Right? If all he talks about is me. You go to someone's house for dinner. Right? We went to lunch to Madan Gopal Prabhu's place. So if at the dining table, all Madan Gopal Prabhu did was talk about me, 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 and I'm like this, and I'm like that, then you sit there going, wow, gosh, well, talk about something else, right? But fortunately, no. He's a very nice person, humble devotee. Whole time he was saying, oh, so how are you doing, Prabhu? How is your family? How's... So he's being generous like this, asking about his guest. But Krishna here, he's in front of Arjun, he's talking about me, me. In every chapter he says, me. Think about me, worship me, my devotee. And when Krishna does it, it actually sounds very nice, right? The whole world reads it and goes, oh, how beautiful this is. how wonderful the Lord is. Because factually, this pronoun, I, or me, the first person pronoun, truly should only apply to Krishna. Right? Krishna is the only proper object, proper recipient of the first person pronoun, I. The pronoun in Sanskrit is aham. Aham means I. The object form of that is mam, which means me. It's the same thing, I or me. And this aham, when we use the word aham to apply to us, then that's a demonstration of what? Of ahamkara. Ahamkara. Ahamkara means what?
False ego.
False ego, right? Making of me. Right? Kara means to make. Constructing my own identity. Putting myself at the center. Ahamkara. Right? The sound of me, of I. I'm at the center, ahamkara. But Krishna is the only one who can truly use this word aham. We are the second person pronoun. We're the third person pronoun. Really, we should only use the word you and he and she. The pronoun I is reserved for Krishna. He's the original I. The first verse of the Chatushloki Bhagavatam, the four essential verses of Bhagavatam, it begins... Krishna speaking these verses to Brahma. He's summarizing the entire philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam in four verses, just like he's doing here for Arjuna. And there also, at the beginning of Chatushloki Bhagavatam, Krishna begins with the word aham. Here he's beginning with aham, there he begins, aham evasam evagre. He's saying, O Brahma, in the beginning, before you were there, before this whole creation was there, in the beginning, there was only I, he says. Ahameva, only me, I. And Prabhupada has a beautiful purport there. He explains that this I, this aham, it actually only belongs to Krishna. Because he's the subject. I means the subject. And everyone else in this world is the object. We're all predicated on Krishna. If you know grammar, it says you have the subject and the object, or the subject and the predicate. Krishna is the subject, and everyone else is meant to be simply an adjective on Krishna. That's what we are. Ramanujacharya, he explains this. He says the relationship between us, between Krishna and us, is a relationship between the noun and an adjective. Krishna is the Purusha, and we simply decorate him in various ways. That's all. Krishna shows us his expertise, his beauty, his multiple personalities through all his creation. We can look at the flowers and say, oh, Krishna is so beautiful, the way the flowers bloom. We can look at the ocean and say, Krishna is so vast, like the power of the ocean. We can look at a flowing river and say, Krishna is so pure, like a river. So all these things in this world, they're just adjectives on Krishna. Krishna is the only subject in this world. And as soon as we start thinking that we're the subject, that's where the problem arises. And so the first thing that Krishna is doing here is he's setting him in his place and us in our place. He says, look, I'm the subject here. If you think anything else is worth talking about, then you're wrong. I'm the subject. I'm the person who everyone should be talking about. Now you want to describe me in terms of other people and in terms of other things, that's okay. But aham. Aham sarvasya prabhava. Matta sarvam pravartate. Everything you see around me, around you, all objects, they're actually just born from me alone. I'm the source of everything. And in the translation, Prabhupada explains that. He says, I'm the source of the material and the spiritual worlds. He explains what sarva means. It means everything means everything we see here and everything in the spiritual world. Nothing, there's nothing in this existence that doesn't come from Krishna. Now, you might ask, well, okay, what does this mean to say that Krishna is the source of everything? What does source mean? What does cause mean, that Krishna is the cause of everything? Did he make it himself? Did he get the raw ingredients from somewhere else? what does this idea of cause mean? And there's two examples that are given in regards to this, to try to explain what it means to be cause. Because this idea of cause sounds like easy to understand, but it's not. It's actually very difficult. Causality, it's a complicated question. Think of it like this. A potter and a pot, right? Potters make pots, clay pots, in the traditional way. They have a potter's wheel, and they take the clay, they form it on their wheel, and out comes the nicely shaped pot. Now, if I were to give you a pot and say, tell me, what is the cause of this pot? Then how might you answer that question? Give me one answer that you might give. What is the cause of the pot?
Clay.
The clay, right? You say, the cause of the pot is the earth out of which it's made. Because if there was no clay, there'd be no pot. Simple. What else might you say as the cause of the pot?
The potter.
The potter. The person who made it. Because if you have a bunch of clay, that's just clay. Right? That's nothing. That's not a pot. You can't hold water in a pile of clay, but you can in a pot. So who does that transformation? It's the potter. So the potter is the cause of the pot. What else might you say? The wheel, right? The instrument being used, that's the cause. Because that instrument is what actually does the fashioning of the pot. What else might you say?
The user.
The person who's the consumer, right? The customer. If there was no user, there was no customer, no one who was going to use that pot, then the potter would not make any pots. They'd be out of business. And these days, most potters are out of business. Because we don't use those types of pots anymore. So, you've got the clay. That's the material cause, or sometimes called the substantial cause, the substance. You've got the potter's wheel. That's the instrumental cause. You've got the potter himself. Right? That's the efficient cause, the person who's actually doing it. And you've got the consumer, the reason for whom, the person for whom it's being done, which is the final cause or the ultimate cause. According to the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita and of Vedanta in general, Krishna, or God, is all four of these things for this creation. He's all four. When Krishna says, I am the source of the material and the spiritual world, I'm the source of everything, I'm the cause of everything, he doesn't just mean it in one way. He's saying, I'm the cause, period. Like he says in Bhagavatam, before me, there was nothing that existed. That means what? The stuff out of which this material world is made, everything we see around us, that's Krishna. The person who makes it, that's Krishna. The person for whom it's being made, that's Krishna. The instrument, the tools that he's using to make it, that's also Krishna. And everything is a transformation of Krishna only. There's nothing else outside of Krishna. Now, we understand that this is true, but Krishna does it through his energies, through his shaktis. In other words, this is Krishna. The wood here and the table here, it's all Krishna in the form of Krishna's energy. One time, they were... devotees were walking with Srila Prabhupada on a morning walk, and they asked him, they said, Prabhupada, a devotee sees Krishna in everything, right? And Prabhupada said, yes. So they said, like this tree here, do they see Krishna sort of hanging on the leaves? Is Krishna all the leaves, and there's the whole tree they see is made up of little four-armed Krishnas, or however, hanging on the tree, and the main trunk is Krishna? Do they see the tree as... And Prabhupada says, no, it's not like that. He said, they see all of this tree as the energy of Krishna. And in this way, they see that Krishna is there. So when Krishna says, I'm the source of everything here, he means that every aspect of creation, should Krishna be absent from it, it would not exist. That's how closely dependent everything is on Krishna. Just like the potter. If the potter was not there, the pot would not exist. But would the clay exist? Yeah, it would exist. So the potter is not the complete cause. He's just one part of the cause. If the potter's wheel is not there, the instrument, okay, then the pot would not exist. But would the potter exist? Yeah, he'd still be there. So the wheel is not the complete cause, right? Only a part of the cause. But Krishna is that one cause that if you take him out of the equation, then everything is zero. Nothing exists. It's all nothing. And this is why, this is exactly what's called Maya. This is how Maya is defined in the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam, next verse. That which appears to be connected to Krishna, that which appears to be separate from Krishna, that's Maya. Anything that appears to exist, to have reality, separate from Krishna, that cannot be real. That's Maya. That which is not, that which is false. Because if it were really separate from Krishna, it wouldn't be there. It would be completely non-existent. So that's the extent to which Krishna is the source of everything. That's the extent to which he's the cause of all things. Not in a very superficial way. Sometimes people have this idea of God as the clockmaker, as the watchmaker. You know this idea? That God creates the world and then he sets it in motion. Like a watchmaker creates the watch and then puts the battery in it and sets it off. And then he sells it and he lets it go. He doesn't deal with it. It just keeps turning. So people sometimes think of God like that. That God is the ultimate watchmaker. He creates this universe and then hands off. Right? You do what you... It just keeps running on its own by the laws of nature. Okay, there's some automation that's there. But no, Krishna is part of everything. He's the watchmaker, but he's also the components of the watch itself. All parts of the watch are also Krishna. So in every aspect of this creation, Krishna is there. There's a wonderful story in the Upanishads. A little boy named Shvetaketu. He goes... he's just finished his education, 12 years. He went to Gurukul. And he comes back, and the Upanishad says, Chandogya Upanishad, it says that he came back all swell-headed, very proud of his education. I've learned it all. I've graduated. And he comes home... And his father asks him, so what did you learn? And he tells him. And then he says, did you learn about that one thing without which nothing can exist? Right? The basis of everything. And the son said, no, I never heard of anything like that. He said, then the father said, so you haven't learned anything. You haven't learned the basic thing. So the son, he was humble enough where he said, okay, then I want to know. Tell me what this is. So the father said, okay, I'll teach you. And he said, you go bring a glass of water and a piece of salt. Bring it here. So the son brings it here. He says, put the salt in the water. Puts it in, stirs it around. He says, now give me the salt. He can't get it. So he says, taste the water. Sip it from here. What does it taste like? Salty. Okay. Now taste it from this side. What does it taste like? Salty. Now taste it from the other side. What does it taste like? Salty. Now throw out the water on these rocks. Come back tomorrow. So he throws out the water, comes back tomorrow, and what's there?
Salt.
The salt. And the father says, this is how the Lord is present in everything in this creation. Just like the salt in the water. It's there throughout the water. You can't see it. People say, well, where is God? You can't see it, but you can experience him. Right? Taste the water. You'll find him. Right? Krishna, we discussed this yesterday. Krishna says in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he says, Raso, or before this, he says, that verse comes early, Rasoham apsukonteya, prabhasmi shashi surya. He says, I'm the taste of water. I'm the light of the sun and the moon. I'm the sound and ether. So you hear any sound, that's Krishna. Right? You taste water, that's Krishna. You can experience him. And you can even see him if you know what to do. Throw out the water, what you have left behind, the salt. You can see it. A devotee knows how to extract Krishna from the creation. Just like, who's the best devotee in this regard? The best example of a devotee who knew how to extract Krishna from the creation, from anything in this creation. He had so much faith. Prahlad. Right? This is what his father asked him. He said, so where is your God? He said, who gives you your power? And Prahlad said, the same person who gives you yours. Which, of course, was not a very diplomatic answer for his father. He got even more angry. He said, so why can't I see him? Where is he? Prahlad says, he's everywhere. Even in this pillar? Yes, he's in this pillar. Throw out the water, you'll see the salt. So he hit the pillar. And because Prahlad had that vision, so Narasimhadev came out to make true the word of his devotee. And there he was, in a pillar. Which means what? If we broke open this table, Krishna is there. Of course, we don't expect to see him, so Krishna doesn't expect to see us. He doesn't come out. Prahlad, he was clear. He said, no, he's here, right? If Prahlad were here and we challenged him, then the Lord would come out. Now, what form he came out in, what he would think of us, that's another question. But Prahlad had that conviction, yes, my Lord is there. And so he was able to extract the salt from the water. People sometimes ask one question in relation to this that may arise. He said, okay, if Krishna is truly so much part of everything, he's the potter, he's the potter's wheel, he's the clay, he's everything. Why can't I find Krishna anywhere? Why is it that everywhere you look in this creation, you see everything except for God?
His grace.
If that's how much he's part of creation, must there be no objective, no scientific process, some way to actually get a handle on the person who's... Just like you find anyone who creates anything, right? Suppose I invent some new thing. What's the first thing I'm going to do? Go around and make sure everyone knows that I invented it. I'm the creator here. Be visible. The CEO of every airline, the airline magazine, the first article comes from the CEO. And he always makes sure that he's speaking directly to his customers. I work at a state university. Every month we're getting an email directly from the governor himself, of the governor of Virginia. Why? He wants to make sure that all his employees know that anything good you're getting in life, it comes from me. Right? We don't hear from him when something goes wrong. Right? But when something goes well, if there's a new raise announced for state employees, he won't have it announced by his juniors. He's the one who's going to announce it. Right? If we get layoffs, pay cuts, then he won't announce it. Then someone else will announce it. This department, that department, and so on. So Krishna is part of everything. Everyone is dependent on him. And yet, he's the one we can't find. Why? He explains this earlier in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 7, where he talks about his position. A beautiful verse. He says, Mattaha parataram nanyat kinchidasti dhananjaya mayi sarvam idam protam sutre manigana viva. He says, matta parataram nanyat. Same point. There's nothing superior to me. Matta parataram, greater than me, na anyat. There's nothing. Kinchid asti, nothing at all. O Dhananjaya, O Arjuna. Mayi sarvam idam protam sutre manigana eva. Everything is resting upon me like pearls are strung on a thread. Sutre manigana eva. And here he gives us a clue. He gives us a hint of just why he makes himself so absent. This is Krishna's intention. If you have a necklace, think about this metaphor. If you have a beautiful necklace, a good necklace, what's the sign, what's the symptom of that necklace? What marks a good necklace? When all of those pearls, they're tight together. In other words, in a good necklace, you'll never see the thread. You'll never see a string. In a nice garland, you won't see a string. Right? If you see one flower here, then string, then one more flower here, then string, one more flower, it means the garland maker is not so good, or else we have a shortage of flowers. One of the two. Any good necklace means what? You cannot see the thread. Right? Pearls are strung on a thread. Krishna, he's the best necklace maker. He's the best garland maker. He's saying, I made this whole world. And he's made it so tight, so tightly woven, that we people go through every single pearl looking for God, and they don't find him. And they conclude, God doesn't exist. God's not there. God is dead. And you can experiment. You can say, look, see this carnation? No thread, just a flower. This one? No thread, just a flower. This one? No thread, just a flower. And everyone is examined. People study the stars in the sky. They study the geology of the earth. They study the reactions of chemicals. They study the laws of physics. They study the power of medicine. They study all the rules of engineering. They study nanotechnology. They study nuclear technology. They've broken open the atom. Now there's supernuclear, that mile-long hydro collider, or whatever it is, hydron collider, under three different countries in Europe, right? Breaking open atoms and subatoms. And there's no God. I've looked at every pearl, one by one and one, and I've never found the thread. So Prabhupada says, in order to understand God, you need a little bit of intelligence. Prabhupada was very nice like that. He put it very clearly. He said, anyone with a little intelligence can understand. Means think about how much intelligence it takes to study every pearl on the thread. And yet, not enough intelligence to understand how are these pearls all hanging together. That much intelligence we don't have. And we conclude, God is not there. Think about this analogy a little bit, of the pearls on a thread. And let me ask you, what can we understand from this metaphor? If you think about pearls on a thread, why does Krishna use this example? One is that you cannot see the thread, right? That's one point that we made. But what else? How is this world like pearls? And how is Krishna like the thread?
It's connected.
Yes.
Right,
so you take away the thread, you cut off the thread, and all the pearls scatter. The whole necklace collapses. In the same way, you take Krishna away from the equation, and everything is scattered. Prabhupada said, everything in this world is zeros, and Krishna is the one. And you put the one before the zeros, and all of a sudden it makes a million. And you take the one away, and all you have is a row of zeros. And in fact, that's true. If you have a pearl without a thread, that pearl may be very valuable, but it's useless. Means you need some kind of thread. You put a pearl on a ring, right? There's a thread holding it to your finger. Okay, maybe it's metal, but the point is you need some kind of thread. You put it on a necklace, you need a thread. You hang it on your ears, you need a thread. A pearl, very valuable. But without a thread, useless. Same thing about this world. Everything in this world, very valuable. Without Krishna, useless. No basis. What else can we learn from the analogy? It's tightly woven. You cut the thread. This pearl scatter. What else?
It is strung so nicely and so perfectly.
Very artistically. Very artistically, Prabhupada said, any devotee can appreciate the beauty of nature. And in this way think, oh, how wonderful Krishna is. How beautiful must be the creator of this nature. How else? What else?
What's the thread without the
pearls?
The thread without the pearls.
The thread without the pearls, exactly. So therefore Krishna says, Krishna is never without the pearls. This is actually a very good point. What's the thread without the pearls? It has no value either. Mm-hmm. And Prabhupada explains that therefore we understand Krishna is never without the pearls. He's never without his energies. Never without this creation, never without the spiritual world, never without his devotees. God, as some sort of abstract energy, all alone, standing in heaven, is not God. That's boring. Very boring. Sometimes people have this concept of God, that God is alone, that God is on his own, that actually God is ultimately abstract. No personality, no people, no relationships. That's the treatment we give to our worst criminals in this world, right? The worst criminals get isolated, solitary confinement. Why would Krishna have that? Why would God put himself into solitary confinement? No. In fact, Jiva Goswami explains that when Krishna says that only I existed in the beginning, what he actually means is I with all my spiritual world, all my friends, all my family, all my relatives, all my devotees, we existed in the beginning. Not alone at all. One devotee, she painted a picture of Krishna and showed it to Prabhupada. Beautiful picture. But Prabhupada says, no, this is not good. You have shown Krishna alone. Krishna is never alone. Never alone. You see pictures of Krishna, at least there's a peacock or a cow or some birds or some cow licking his feet or the gopis are there or the cowherd boys are there. Balaram is there, Radharani is there. Krishna is never alone. Never a thread without pearls. The pearls are always there. Very nice, very nice. Nice realization. How else can we understand? Yes?
Maybe you've made this point already, but the necklace of pearls, it doesn't make itself. Doesn't self-manifest.
Right.
For it to exist, there has to be some intelligence that put it
that puts it together. Exactly. Yeah. There has to be someone there who does it. Yes?
Why did he create this in the first place? That this has been asked so many times, been a lot of attempts to answer this. And still, the question comes up is why did he create this confusion for us? It's so confused.
Okay. If you can just hold that question for, say, 15 minutes, we're coming to that very point. Okay? Give me some more. Yes, here. Yeah. How is this world like pearls? Can you think about that a little bit? In what way is this world like pearls? In the back, you had your hand raised.
I think it's also, we can look at, it's kind of create balance, organization, kind of system, because they're all on a string.
Yes.
So there is some structure to it.
Yes. Yes, very good. And this goes with the idea of design.
Design.
That everywhere we, yes, good point. Everywhere we look, we find structure. It's not a random collection of pearls that someone said, here it is, and just scattered them everywhere. But there's structure involved. And they found this, right? The more we study nature, even up to the tiniest level, the molecular, atomic level, everything is structured beautifully. Everything has wonderful structure. Nothing is sort of just thrown like that. Nice point. What else? Yes?
Well, if you look at the planets, solar system, universe, everything seems to be roundish, like pearls.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Everything is round. Good, yes? Sorry, either one. Yeah, in the back.
If Krishna's the thread, and then the pearls are on the string, we're hiding the thread, which means that the pearls are more beautiful than the thread.
Mm.
So how could something be more beautiful than Krishna?
Yeah. No, Krishna is the thread. But he's also the whole necklace, right? This is the point that we're making here. That Krishna is saying, it's me who runs, who supports everything. But also everything that's created is part of him. In other words, this is a little unusual necklace. It means the thread is producing the pearls, which is rather odd, I must admit. Yes. Yes?
That they're all, they all look the same, but they're all uniquely different.
Yes.
Different.
Yes.
And that as a whole, it makes the necklace its beauty. Without the whole, there is no necklace.
Okay, beautiful. Both points, excellent. Every pearl is unique and valuable. This analogy completely destroys Mayavad ideas, right? Mayavad philosophy. Every pearl has to be unique. That's number one. It has to be individual. If all the pearls were one, if they were fused together, what would happen? You wouldn't have a necklace. You'd have a stick. Right? You'd have a stick, which was completely inflexible. The only way it works as a necklace is every pearl is unique and valuable. And valuable. And that's how we are in this world. Each one of us is a pearl on Krishna's necklace. Each one of us. We may be tiny pearl or big pearl. It doesn't matter. But we have our role to play. And we're very valuable in Krishna's eyes. Sure, there may be millions and trillions of pearls on this necklace. But even if one pearl is missing, there's a hole in the necklace. Right? Something's broken. You notice that. So each one of us is so valuable. Not the biggest devotees, not just the people who are the most expert at something, but every single individual is valuable. And we've got a unique spot on that necklace. When we are not playing our role on that necklace, when we refuse to be part of Krishna's necklace, Krishna feels very hurt by that. And he misses us. He misses us because there's a gap in the necklace. And he knows someone is missing here. And we have a very distinctive, unique role to play. Krishna has given every one of us some assets, some skills, some abilities, some proficiency, some capability. Everyone. Everyone. Why? Because that's the nature of the soul, right? The Atma. No one can say, I have nothing. Every individual, Krishna has given something special. And all we have to do is take our place on that necklace. To say, I'm willing to use that asset, I'm willing to use that skill in Krishna's service. Then, as you're saying, the second point, together, the whole thing looks very nice. Looks very beautiful. One pearl you might miss. It might get lost in a whole collection of pearls. But a necklace altogether, very beautiful. Very beautiful. So this is what Krishna is saying here. That I am the source of the material and the spiritual worlds. Of everything that exists. It's actually a very, very deep point. So profound it is, this point. So profound that Krishna says, someone who really understands this point, that I am the source of everything, iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. That person who really understands this point, he will love me with his full heart, with full devotion. Now think about this for a minute. If what Krishna is saying is that if we know him, we will love him. Mm-hmm. Which means what? If we don't love Krishna, then we don't know him. Then we don't know him. In other words, there's no way that you can say, I know Krishna and I don't like him. Means you don't really know him. Right? You don't really know him. With us it can happen. Right? I know Madan Gopal Prabhu, I don't like him. Right? It happens with us regularly, right? Some not with us, I mean in general. But have you experienced this with people? Right? The more you get to know someone, the more you go, maybe I should keep my distance. We had one of my classmates in Oxford. We were studying together. He had this T-shirt. It was wonderful. Actually, we got it for him on his birthday. It said, the more people I meet, the more I like my dog. The more people I meet, the more I like my dog. Right? And that's the nature of this world. Right? People often turn out to be a disappointment. You know someone from a distance. We were talking about this yesterday. Right? On Facebook, everyone looks brilliant. They look like they're all beautiful. Right? Perfect lives. Everyone's got a perfect life on Facebook. You look at their vacation pictures, and the rainy days are never there. Right? The messed up hotel, whatever it was that went wrong, the delayed flight, the lost baggage. No. You have the picture perfect, everyone. Look at us. We're the perfect family. Right? Right? This is Facebook. This is the material world. This is Maya. Right? This presentation of perfection. And then you scratch under the surface, you get to know them and you realize, oh, they're just normal like me. They've got their problems. Things don't work out perfectly in their life. They did a study recently, I just came out, saying that Facebook increases depression in a lot of people. And the reason for that, it wasn't just that you're spending a lot of time in front of a computer, but the reason they said was actually pretty logical. They found that it creates an impression of the whole world as happy. Right? But the only person you really know what they're going through is yourself. So you think, I'm the only one who has a mixed bag. Some happiness and some problems, right? Everyone else's family looks perfect. Everyone else's vacation looks perfect. Everyone else's house looks perfect. Their lives are perfect, but mine is the only one. So it creates this false impression of I'm worse off than everyone else, and that creates depression. So this is the nature of this world. You find, you get to know someone a little bit more, and you realize, well, there's both sides. When you first get married, the partners are just ideal, right? Wife is Chandramukhi. She's just perfect. After a few years, she becomes Surajmukhi. Still okay, right? Still okay, you need her. But heavy, like the sun. Right? Some years later, Jwalamukhi. There's a volcano. Why? You get to know someone a little closer. Okay. I'm being a little sarcastic here. You get to know their good qualities. Those emerge better. But you also get to know that it's a mixed bag, right? We've got some compromises to make. There's some problems, and I've got some problems. And we learn about this, about each other, in any relationship. With Krishna, the more you get to know Krishna, the more you love him. He's the one person who will never disappoint in his relationship. That I said I would be loyal, but actually I wasn't. He does that sometimes in Vrindavan, but that's a different thing. He says in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna refers to him as Achyuta, the infallible one. One who never fails in what? In his relationship with his devotees. He never fails. When he gives his word to his devotee, Krishna will not fail. In Bhagavatam, there's a wonderful verse. It says, Satyam vidhatum nijabhritya bhashitam. This is in the Prahlad story. It says, the Lord appeared in this far out form, half man, half lion. Satyam vidhatum nijabhritya bhashitam. Just to make true the words of his devotee. He came as half man, half adbhuta rupam, it says. A form that was never before seen. Think, Krishna is coming down and taking what amounts to a very odd form. He's God. He should be descending from the spiritual world in four arms on the back of Garuda. Instead, he jumps out of a pillar. And it comes as half man, half lion, where Hiranyakashipu looks at him and he says, who is this? This is your God? A beast? And he's laughing at him. Krishna's willing to do all of that. Just, says, Satyam vidhatum nijabhritya bhashitam. Just to keep the word of his devotee. One great poet, Acharya from South India, Sri Vaishnav, he says in his meditation, in a feeling of love, he says, the Lord, he's so panicky. When Prahlad says, yes, my Lord is here, he's sitting there in Vaikuntha thinking, oh my God, I have to go. Right? Prahlad said, I'm going to be here. Right? So he leaves in such a rush that he forgets all his weapons in Vaikuntha, chakra and everything. And so when he comes to kill Hiranyakashipu, all he has is just his nails to tear him apart. And he says he's jumping from one pillar to another in Hiranyakashipu's palace, thinking, what if he hits this one? I got to be here. What if he hits this one? This is devotee's mood in talking about. Just the point he's making is what? The Lord is so completely overtaken by his devotee, just to keep his word true. So loyal Krishna is, so infallible, that the more we get to know him, the more we love him. Krishna is saying, iti matva, if you know this, bhajante ma, you'll worship me. Buddha, those who are intelligent. Bhava samanvita. How? Not with awe and reverence, but with bhava, with feeling. Not just with, oh my God, I should worship him, otherwise he'll kill me. No, bhava, with some feeling. Yes, my Lord is so wonderful. You see this in the story of the four Kumaras, when they visited Krishna for the first time, Lord Vishnu in Vaikuntha, four little boys. And they had heard about Krishna a lot. And because they had heard about him, they developed a curiosity. I want to go see who this Krishna is. Same thing, but Buddha, they were intelligent. Thought, okay, Krishna, it says, is so wonderful. Let me go see him, Lord Narayan. So they went to Vaikuntha. And we know the story. They were stopped at the gateway. Finally, they went in and so on. They actually never went in. They were stopped at the gate and then they cursed the doorkeepers, Jai and Vijay. So the Lord, he got very worried because his devotees were being cursed. So he came out from inside. I'll tell you a little detail about this. It's a beautiful story. He says, when the four Kumaras come up, they're stopped. They're little boys, right? So Jai and Vijay, the doorkeepers in Vaikuntha, they stop them. And they say, you cannot enter. Because they don't know who these boys are. They look like kids who've lost their way or something. And they say, no, only the Lord's great devotees come here. But they're little children and they're great sages and they get very upset at being stopped. So they curse Jai and Vijay. They say, you see differences between people. Bhedabhava. You see higher and lower, good and bad. In a place where there you should see no difference. You have fear of invaders in a place where there should be no fear. Therefore, you're showing this fear and this discrimination. Therefore, you don't deserve to be in the spiritual world. You go down to the material world. That's the land of fear. That's the land of discrimination. You go there. So they curse him. You should go down. The Lord, he hears about this. He knows everything. He's Sarvakya. And he comes at this point to try to calm things down. He's very worried, Bhagavatam says, about for his devotees. And the first thing he does is he praises the four Kumaras. He says, actually, you are Brahmins, and therefore you're worshipable. Even if you cut off my arm and my leg, I will accept it and give it to you as an offering. He says this exact analogy. He says, even if you cut off my arms and my legs, I will accept it and give it to you. In this way, he's telling a very important point. He's saying, these Jai and Vijay are like my arms and my legs, and you've just cut them off. The Lord is very protective about his devotees. They may have made a little bit of a mistake, but it was not in bad intention. It was an honest mistake. They got confused. They had not seen it, the Lord. And so the Lord hints like this. He'll honor the Brahmins. He's saying, no, you're very great. But he says, you've cut off my arms and my legs. It's okay. I'll take them. Take them if you want to take them. So the Kumaras, they immediately feel very bad and they ask for forgiveness from the Lord. The Acharyas say that actually the four Kumaras were not at fault either. They were little children. And you know, a little child, he never thinks that I should go here, I shouldn't go here. A small five-year-old boy, he'll run into any place. Right? Even someone's bedroom, he'll just walk in. No concept that, oh, I shouldn't go there. Then as they grow up, we teach them, oh, you should knock, don't, ask first, don't just go like that. And if you stop a child from going somewhere, then a child immediately becomes very upset. And if my boy, Chaitanya, he runs here and I pull him back, he'll get upset. Why are you doing this? I want to be here. So like that, the Kumaras, they were stopped, so they got a little upset. And they didn't think, they cursed them. Anyway, the Lord came out. They never entered Vaikuntha, actually. The Lord came out. And this is the crucial point. As soon as they saw the Lord, before they even saw him, what happened? They smelled the fragrance of Tulsi coming from his lotus feet. It says, a beautiful verse, Tasyaravinda nayanasya padaravinda kinjal kamisha tulasi makaranda vayo. Tasyaravinda nayanasya padaravinda kinjal kamisha tulasi makaranda vayo. Antargata swavivarena chakara tesham sankshobhamaksharajusham apichitta tanvo. It says, Tasyaravinda nayanasya padaravinda. When these boys, they saw the lotus feet of the lotus-eyed Lord. Aravinda nayanasya padaravinda. Aravinda nayanasya, the lotus-eyed Lord. They saw his lotus-like feet, padaravinda. Kinjalka mishra tulasi makaranda vayu. And they smelled the fragrance of tulasi mixed with camphor, mixed with the fragrance of his feet. His feet have their own beautiful fragrance. Not like our feet, they get smelly. Krishna's feet, beautiful fragrance. So that original fragrance of Krishna's lotus feet, mixed with the fragrance of tulsi, mixed with camphor and whatever other things offered to him. Antargata svavivarena. It went inside their nostrils. Chakara tesham sankshobham. Aksharajusham. These people, these boys who were aksharajusham, they were fixed in a steady state of equilibrium. No, never getting angry, never emotional, never upset. What happened? Sankshobham. They got agitated. Agitated chitta tanvo, in heart and in body, for the first time in their lives. You know why they were boys? Why they were 5-year-old boys? They were the oldest sages in the universe, the first sons of Brahma. But they stayed 5-year-old boys just so they would never have to experience the agitation that comes with youth. The first time you realize that you're attracted to a girl or attracted to a boy, that agitation that's born, they said, we don't want to have to deal with that. So let's stay 5 years old. So people who had never experienced any kind of agitation in their life before, for the first time, they see Krishna. And just the fragrance from his feet sends them for a complete spin. Sankshobham means they're completely trembling, agitated. Their bodies and their minds, both. All their yogic steadiness finished in one go. And they hadn't even touched the Lord. Can you imagine what it would be to see the Lord's beautiful face, to touch him, to embrace him? So, what's the point? You get to know Krishna. The more you get to know Krishna, the more you love him. And if we don't know Krishna, if we don't love Krishna, or we love him only a little bit, means we don't know him. Or we know him only a little bit. I'll give you one more example. Very beautiful. Rukmini Devi. You know, she was the daughter of the king of Vidarbha. Her father's name was Bhishmaka. And she had 5 brothers. 4? 5? I forget now.
Five
brothers. The eldest was Rukmi. Rukmi, Rukma Ratha, Rukmi. They're all named Rukma something. And her father was very saintly. So the king, he was a very good king. And so in his court, all these sages used to come, devotees. And when they'd come, they'd all talk about Krishna and how wonderful he was. And Krishna was there on the planet at that time. And Rukmini, she was a young girl. She'd listen to this from her childhood. Krishna's so beautiful. Bhagavatam says she heard about the 6 opulences of Krishna. He's the strongest. He's the most beautiful. He's the most handsome. He's the most famous, and he's so renounced, and all this. And she just gave her heart to Krishna. But her eldest brother, Rukmi, arranged her marriage with Shishupal out of envy of Krishna and out of favoritism for his friend, Shishupal, who was Krishna's sworn enemy. So Rukmini, she found this out, and she was very, very morose, very sad. And Prabhupada writes in Krishna book, he says, but she was a king's daughter, so she wasn't about to just settle with being sad. Right? Oh, my life is bad, what do I do? You know, she was a king's daughter. She said, I'm going to do something about this. Right? Let's do some diplomacy. She knew how to work these things. And so she found a very trustworthy Brahmin and with him sent a letter. And in that letter she wrote to Krishna. She said, "My dear Lord, I've heard all about your good qualities. And now I want to marry you." She says, "I know that you might be thinking that maybe I'm not a very chaste girl. I'm just thinking of other men and I've sent proposals." It's kind of embarrassing in Vedic culture for a girl to send a proposal like that to someone, to make the first step. Even in Western culture, right? Mm-hmm. They expect the man to always make the first move. Right? The man goes, you know, with the engagement ring, says, "Will you marry me?" It's kind of odd for the girl to do that. So she's feeling a little embarrassed. She says, I don't know what you might be thinking of me, that I'm sort of a shady character, not so reliable, unchaste." But she says, "It's not like that, Krishna." She said, "Anyone, even the most chaste and married woman," she says, "I'm unmarried, even the most chaste and married woman in this world, if she heard about your good qualities, she would want to marry you. She would fall in love with you. So Krishna, please let me speak shamelessly. I'm in love with you. I want to marry you. Please come and take." What's her point? Anyone who knows about Krishna, they would love you. It's the same point she's making here. Iti matva bhajante ma buddha bhava samagata. With feeling they would love you. With real feeling. And so Krishna comes and he kidnaps Rukmini. He tells the Brahmin, he says, "Actually, I've been thinking about her too." He says, "I've had sleepless nights," Krishna says. Can you imagine? He says, "I can't sleep at night because I'm thinking about her so much." So it was mutual. Krishna, he also loved her very much. She's the goddess of fortune. Also in South India, you know the story of Andal, one of the Alvars? She was a young girl also, the daughter of a king. Not of a king, actually. A pujari, right? A priest in the temple. And she was very young, maybe what, 12, 13, something like that, 14, like that. And she, same thing, she decided that I'm going to marry Vishnu, that's it, Lord Narayan, no one else. And she would decorate herself, her hair, very, very beautifully. Every day she'd go to the temple and she'd decorate herself like a devi, like a goddess. You know, when we come to the temple, we try to wear something simple, so that people don't confuse who's the deity there. Nice earrings. But she would dress herself up very nicely. That made Krishna, for Krishna, that he should be pleased to look upon me. She loved him very much. And people used to criticize her. "Why are you dressing like this?" She'd make garlands every day for Krishna. And she'd wear the garlands first herself to make sure they were comfortable and they were nice. Then she would offer them to the Lord. One day her father found out about this, and so he refused to offer the garland. Krishna got so upset. He came in the dream, and it was a whole incident that happened because of that. He was so attached to those garlands. So she decided, and in the end she got her wish. She married Lord Narayan. Atma ramas chamunayo nirgrantha apyurukrame. Bhagatam says that even if someone is completely perfect, completely renounced, completely detached from everything in the material world, when they hear about the qualities of Krishna, bhaktim, they will want to love him. They will want to do his devotional service. Ittam bhuta guno hari. This is the amazing quality of Krishna. This is his wonderful. So we need to think about this for ourselves and ask the question. He says, how much do I really love Krishna? And therefore, how much do I really know him? And if we don't know Krishna well, then we have to find out about him. We have to find out about him. It says that the Srimad Bhagavatam is Krishna's own body. All 12 cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, each canto is one part of his body. The first two cantos, or Pada Padma, it's his lotus feet. Next couple cantos, his knees, then his waist, then his broad chest, then his neck, then his face. And the 10th canto, his beautiful smiling face. And the 5 chapters of the Rasa Lila are specifically the Lord's smile. Very enchanting. Then 11th and 12th canto, his crown. The entire Srimad Bhagavatam, this is how we can get to know Krishna, is by studying Bhagavatam inside out. One time, my Guru Maharaj, Hanubhat Preshaka Swami, he asked us, so how many chapters in the first 2 cantos of Bhagavatam? And we were all like, 15, 19, 20. No. And so Maharaj looked at it and said, you know, if Krishna came here, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between his feet and that of a buffalo. Truly. Because we say, oh, I know Krishna, right? I worship Krishna, I love him. If Krishna walked in at this moment, would we recognize him? Would we know him? Do we know him well enough? He was walking all around Duryodhan. Did Duryodhan understand him? Did he recognize him? No. He thought, oh, he's a greater Mayavi than I am. He's better at magic than I am, right? That's all he thought. And I'll find out some form of magic which will be stronger than Krishna. He thought this whole life, he thought like that. If Krishna were to walk in now, what's the guarantee we actually know him well enough to recognize him? Through Srimad Bhagavatam, through Bhagavad Gita. By hearing his words, by describing his glories, we can come to know Krishna in intimate detail. So that if he were to walk in this room, we recognize him. We know him. This is who he is. When we look at the deity, we see Krishna. Not a statue, but Krishna himself. This is exactly what happens to Arjun after he hears these 4 verses. Iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. Krishna saying, you know this, you will end up becoming overcome with feeling. And that's what happens. After these 4 verses, we mentioned this yesterday, Arjun turns around and says, param brahma, param dhamma, pavitram paramam bhavat, purusham shashvatam divyam, adidevam ajam vibhum. You are the eternal, you're the supreme. He's becoming totally emotional. Repeating himself over and over again, param brahma, param dham, pavitram, param, my lord, you're the best, you're the supreme, you're the highest, over and over again. He's going like this. He's overcome with bhava because he actually knows Krishna after reading these 4 verses. And that should be the result when we hear. God is one person whom if you know him, if you meet him, your life can never be the same. If I meet someone on the street, then later on I think, well, who did I meet? I think I know him by face. Right? And we have trouble putting the name to the face. Krishna is not like that. You can't come home one day and say, oh, honey, I met Krishna today. He says, oh, yeah, and did you bring the milk too? It's not like that. Oh, what's next? Right? Krishna's saying, no, if you see Krishna, if you know Krishna, your life is completely changed. And it's transformed. It can't be the same anymore. And that's the mark of someone who really understands Bhagavad Gita. Yesterday there was a question. How do you know you're understanding Bhagavad Gita as it is? The evidence that you're understanding Bhagavad Gita as it is that your life changes. Is that your life changes. If life doesn't change, then you may be reading Gita, but you're not actually understanding. Okay, so let me pause here and ask if there are any questions or comments. And I know there were a couple of hands in the middle, which I postponed. So any questions or comments at this point? Yes?
You had said that that Krishna works through everybody, that pretty much what I understood is that people's actions are Krishna's actions. So how do you relate that to like maybe a negative action versus a positive?
Yeah. Okay, good question. The question is, how do you, if Krishna is working through everyone in this world, and Krishna is part of everything, as we just described, right? He's the efficient cause, the substantive cause, he's the pot and the clay. Then how do you how do you understand negative actions, bad things that happen, right? That's the question. So it's actually something that really logically follows from this verse. If Krishna is saying, I am everything, the source of everything, then you might raise the question, well, does this mean he's the source of all the evil in this world too? All the bad things that happen in this world. Everyone who gets killed and everyone who gets hurt and bad character and all those things. And yes, in one way he is, but in an opposite sense. As I was mentioning yesterday, that everything that's negative in this world is the absence of Krishna. There's no positive substance. It says, Krishna Surya Sama Maya Hoyandakar Jaha Krishna Tahinaya Maya Radhikar. Krishna is like the sun. Wherever and Maya is like darkness. Wherever there's Krishna, there can be no darkness. So darkness or evil or problems or whatever it is, this is absence of Krishna or forgetfulness of Krishna. Like it says, the back of God, the shadow of the Lord. In some sense, darkness is also created by the sun. Because when the sun is not there, then you have darkness. A shadow is the product of the sun. If I stand in front of the sun, behind me will be the shadow. Why? Because if there was no sun, there would be no shadow. On a cloudy day, for example, are there any shadows? No shadows on cloudy days, because there's no sun. So the same way with Krishna. Everything that's negative or material in this world is there, it's a product of Krishna, but in a negative way. It's the absence of the Lord when the Lord is not present. Or when he's forgotten. He cannot really be absent, but when we forget him. So forgetfulness of Krishna becomes the cause of all types of bad qualities in this world. And remembrance of Krishna becomes the source of all kinds of good. Whenever we see anything that's negative in this world, then we understand, okay, Krishna is forgotten. It's a result of people are not remembering Krishna. I've not remembered Krishna. Let me remember Krishna. Then everything becomes good. It becomes positive.
But Lord Ravana always used to worship Lord Shiva, right?
Mm.
Then
say again.
Ravana always used to worship Lord Shiva.
Mm.
So he is always in touch with the God, right? Shiva is also a God.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, you can.
He punished Ravana, right?
Yeah, but he was not worshipping Lord Shiva as the Supreme Lord. He was using Lord Shiva simply to get what he needed. Right? Ravana's whole point was, his whole mood of worship was, let me enjoy Krishna's property. Let me enjoy Lakshmi without Narayan. This was his mood. I want to enjoy God's property without God. Let me take God out of the picture, but enjoy what belongs to God. And therefore that's Maya. That's where all the negative qualities come from. It means, let me forget Krishna, but I want everything that belongs to Krishna. Let me enjoy Sita without Ram. Yes, Lakshmi is there. She'll happily give us everything we need to enjoy. But if we want her without Narayan, then we're abusing. Then it's abuse. It's immoral. It's inappropriate. And so that was Ravana's problem. Otherwise, he was a very capable person, very dharmic also. He did a lot of yajnas, he was a great pandit. He came from a family of rishis, and of Pulastya Muni. So materially, he was excellent. The only problem was, he didn't want Krishna in the picture. And that, by its very definition, is Maya. You can think of Maya like a one-way mirror. You know these, they have an office building sometimes, or for focus groups or something. Those who are inside can see right through it to the outside, so you can see what's going on. But if you're on the outside, you just see a mirror. You see your own reflection. That's like Maya. Maya is there in front of Krishna. He says in Gita, Yoga Maya Samavrita. I'm covered by my Yoga Maya. So someone might think, oh, Krishna's under Maya. Krishna's in Maya. Right? Because he's covered by Maya. No, it's like this one-way mirror. Krishna's behind it. Maya has no covering for him. He sees right through it. And he sees all of us very clearly. But we look at that glass, and what do we see? Ourselves. Right? This is called ahankara. Right? This is our problem. We look at it and we go, oh, it's just me. Right? I'm on the wall of this building. Right? Someone painted me, and we become so proud. Not realizing that inside the building, someone's sitting there going, look at all these people, right? He's observing all of us in complete privacy. And that's what Krishna says, mohitam nabijanati. The whole world doesn't know me. I'm completely private. Krishna's sitting there behind his wall of maya, observing all of us in perfect privacy, watching everything we do. He says he's the sakshi, the witness in the heart. And when we try to find him, all we see is our own big egos. I'm this and I'm that. I'm this. That's how maya works, like a one-way mirror. Yeah, maya javanika chalnam, he says. I'm covered by my maya. It cannot cover Krishna, but it covers us completely. Other questions?
Yes.
You say in the beginning Krishna was with his relatives, family, and all that, but Krishna is in everyone, so isn't everyone in the beginning then?
Yeah, that's a good question. Krishna is in everyone, so doesn't everyone exist in the beginning? And the answer is yes. That we are eternal. We're eternal. In fact, we're coming from Krishna like the light of the sun is coming from the sun. But there's no point at which Krishna creates us. We're always there with him, eternally, because we're his energy. So we're there, the spiritual world is there, all his associates, all his relatives, everything is there. The only thing that's not there in the beginning is our karma, our activities, our desire to enjoy separately from him. That's all. Otherwise, everything is there. It's just this desire to be separate from Krishna. That's the only thing that has a beginning. Everything else, no beginning. It's all eternal. Everything is eternal. My Guru Maharaj, he always says that you know, we never fall from the spiritual world. We jump from the spiritual world. Good point, no? You don't fall from the spiritual world, we jump. Means it's no accident. Oops, I slipped. Now I'm in the material world. Or someone pushed me off. But we jump. It's that desire that's the problem. Otherwise, everything is eternal. That's our philosophy. Everything is satya. Everything is true. Nothing is false. Who else had their hand up? Yes.
We hear about the three types of energies, major energies, which is considered spiritual energy, marginal energy, and material energy. And we are considered as a product of marginal energy.
Yes.
So my question is, how are we different between the spiritual energy? Because when you say that we jump from spiritual energy, then that means we have been marginal energy from the very beginning.
Yeah. Yes.
And are we going to be the spiritual product of marginal energy even if we are liberated?
Yes, yes. We're always the marginal energy, right? The example that's given in this regard is like water and land. Okay? Krishna is like the land. This material world, Maya, is like water. And we are the shore. The shore. So the shore... What is the shore? What is the beach? What do we call the beach? It's still land, right? But half the time it's covered with water and half the time it's dry, depending on the movement of the tide. That's our nature. We're land. We're just like Krishna. We're spiritual. But because we have the tendency to be washed over by the waves, we're on the shore. That's why we're called marginal or tatastha, on the shore. That's why. Otherwise, we're actually the spiritual energy. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna only divides it twice. He says, Apareyam itastanyam praktim vidhimeparam bhuta jiv bhuta mahabahu yayedam dhayate jagat. He says there's this material energy, bhumirapo nalovayu, earth, water, fire, ether, and then there's my spiritual energy, my superior energy, bas. That's all he says. So really, we're part of the spiritual energy. But we have a tendency to be covered by the material energy. So that's why we're put in a separate category. As tatastha, as someone on the edge, marginal, on the shore.
So Jay and Vijay, who are really who've been cursed by the Kumaras, are they also marginal energies? Right?
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, so they come down. It's not the same way as our coming down, right? They're really not jumping. They're pushed on the spiritual. That's they're actually falling from the spiritual, right? Because they've been pushed off. We jump. They want to come back. We don't want to go home. A big difference. Yes. That option is always there. Because Krishna will never take away our freedom. He'll never shackle us, tie us down, put handcuffs and say, you have to stay here in the spiritual world. He'll always give us that option because he wants us to love him, and love is always voluntary. But after you've learned your lesson, right, once burned, twice shy, they say, then very little chance, right? Yeah. The material world is eternal. It's always been there. Right? It's sometimes it's manifest, sometimes unmanifest. Lord Mahavishnu breathes in, it's all disappeared. He breathes out, it's there. But the material world has always been there. It's eternal. Prakriti is eternal. And the reason is because there's always some living entities that want a playground separate from God. And they like to enjoy it. And that's the simply an exercise of their free will. That's all. Just like a child. Child says, I want to go out. I want to do this. And they have a tantrum. You say, no, you stay here. No, I want to go out. I'll give you something better. No, I want to go out. And they just insist. They're throwing a tantrum. Why? It's just their free will, right? The first time a child learns to say no, you know, all he says is no. He wants to eat. Huh? Like Chaitanya, he'll want to eat. He'll say, you want to eat? Mamam joyche? And he says, nah. And then he'll eat. He'll put something in his mouth. Well, he keep going, nah. Right? And they say, why? Why does a child keep saying no when he first learns it? Because it's the only way he can use his free will. Right? He can display some, no, I don't want it. He's got some control now. I can say no now. I've learned how to deny something, how to say no. So it's fun to experiment with that newfound power. A little baby has no ability to refuse. You have to tell it when to stop. But as soon as he grows up a little bit, he learns that I have free will, I can use it. So it's the same thing. We're immature. We're foolish. We learn, oh, I can say no. I can leave the spiritual world. I can do something independently. Let me do it. I want to go. Krishna says, come on, stay here. It's more fun. No, I want to go. No, I'm going to go. So Krishna says, okay, you go. Here's a playground. Come back before it gets dark. Yes.
So basically Krishna enjoys the play.
Hmm?
Basically, Krishna enjoys the play, like, he know, like, people are doing wrong, and he know that people are coming back to him. He can very well, you know, make people confined to himself. But does he enjoy the play, like?
Yeah. See, let me ask you this. A child goes outside to play. The parents enjoy it, no? They like to come and play with the child and bring him home. If the child doesn't want to come home, will the parents enjoy it? No. They get full of anxiety, right? They get really, really upset. Same thing with Krishna. Okay, he likes to come to the material world, have fun with his devotees. He comes as Lord Ram, and he comes as Krishna, and he comes as Narsingadev, and he protects his devotees, and he fights with the demons, and gets to do all kinds of things he doesn't get to do in the spiritual world. So it's nice. It's fun and games. But then our refusal to come home, he comes to the material world to play with us and to give us an invitation to come home, to tell us, chalo theek ab chalo, let's go home. You've had enough time in the playground. And then when we say no, then Krishna is not happy. Right? He gets worried. He gets very upset. He doesn't enjoy that, the living entity's departure from the material world. So just like any parent, he says, mamai vangshu jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. He says, they're all my parts. They're all like my children. When he sees us struggling, mana shashtan indriyani prakriti stani karshati, he sees how much we're struggling in the material world. We get into fights on the playground. We pull each other's hairs out. And we fight. We punch each other. And Krishna is not happy. He says, stop it, come home, it's over. But no, I'm going to do it, I'm going to stay here. Okay, yes.
On that scenario of the playground of the lost child that doesn't want to come home, if that child had a baby and had lost, had given all of her identity into her child, and then she lost her child, what do you say to that? How does she come home if she doesn't want to listen to anybody?
I don't understand the question.
So I have a friend that lost her daughter.
Mm.
And so she has pretty much lost all her identity in her daughter.
Mm.
And so because of that, she has shunned away from Krishna.
Mm.
And she just will not listen to anybody. And she's going into such a deep depression that she's pretty much going to lose herself if she continues on this path. So what do you say to somebody like that?
Yeah. Yeah, the suffering in the material world is so intense. Sometimes it brings us closer to Krishna, and sometimes it tears us farther apart. Sometimes we see Krishna in our suffering, and other times we see Krishna's absence. And in a situation like that, you cannot tell someone, okay, now you should worship Krishna. Right? See Krishna, all he's helped you. It's very difficult. At that point, the best one can do is to offer a supporting hand of friendship and allow them their time, right? To help them in whatever way that you can to recover first. And then their relationship with Krishna can heal also. Right? We had similar experience in our own family. Right? Some very, very difficult circumstances. And people get turned off from the Lord. For whatever reason, they feel betrayed by God. They feel that the Lord left me, or how whatever they might be feeling. So we give them their own time, and we allow them to heal, and we help them to heal, and then later on, if they'll come, they'll see their relationship with Krishna again. These things are very difficult to handle in the moment. Only in hindsight we look back and we think, oh, okay, there was something I was meant to grow from that experience in some way. But in the moment, you cannot tell someone like that. Right? And the person needs to work that out in their own good time. Yes?
I'm sure you answered this already, but I don't think it's clear for me. You said that a good necklace, the string is hidden.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So why is it good that Krishna hides himself?
Yes. Why does Krishna hide himself? Okay. That's a good question. Why does Krishna hide himself? We said he's hidden in the necklace, he's hidden in the water, the salt is dissolved. Right? He says in the Gita over and over again, Yoga Maya Samavita, Mudhoyam Nabi Janati, people don't know me, the world doesn't know me, Mam Tu Veda Nakashchana, no one knows me. Why? Why is Krishna being so hidden? Yeah, because in this way he's allowing us to exercise our free will. The spiritual world is a place where you cannot avoid Krishna even if you try. Everyone there is fully Krishna conscious. Everything there is alive. They say every step is a dance, right? A dance glorifying Krishna. Every word is a song glorifying Krishna. You cannot avoid Krishna in the spiritual world. We come to the material world specifically because we want to break from Krishna. If Krishna were to come here and put himself in our face and say, now I'm here, I made this whole thing, then again, we're going to be frustrated, right? Krishna is very kind. He's very, very kind. It's an aspect of his mercy that he hides himself in the material world. Just so we can do what we want to and forget him. We don't have to think of him. Imagine how merciful this is. How humble the Lord is, how selfless. He arranges this whole material world for us. Puts everything nice. He gives food to all the animals. He sets up the whole ecological system. He arranges the modes of nature. He gives everything perfectly. And then he hides himself. And says, now you go and enjoy, and you don't have to worry about me. When we make something, the first thing we want is to get credit for it. That at the very least someone should say, oh, thank you, Radhikraman did this for me. Right? We want people to at least be grateful when we do something. Krishna, he's not even asking for that in the material world. He gives us everything and then he hides himself. Just so we can think that I did it all. Just so we can think that. And so in this way, he allows us to exercise our free will. This is why he also gives us delayed karma. Sometimes people wonder, why don't I get karma immediately? Then I would learn better.
Yeah.
Suppose I do something bad to Mother. I'm picking on him today, right? I do something bad to Madan Gopalapur. Why don't I get the karma immediately? Something fall on my head or chandelier break or something. Why not? Later on, 10 years down the road, then someone does something bad to me and I feel bad. If I got it immediately, I wouldn't do it. I would learn. But what free will would you have? If the minute you did something bad, you got burnt, would you have the ability to do anything bad? Would you be able to do anything bad? No, of course not. Right? It's like Pavlov's dogs, right? The minute you do something wrong and you get an electric shock, or whatever, whoever's dogs they were, I don't know, but these experiments, right? You get an electric shock the minute you do behavior that's unwanted. Then are you going to do that behavior? You cannot. So Krishna's not made the material world like that. He gives us plenty of space. The reaction takes another 10 years, maybe a lifetime, to get back to us. In the meantime, we can think, hey, I got away with it. It was the perfect crime. And we think, ah, wonderful. He makes this material world so we can do the perfect crime and think that it was perfect, even though there is no perfect crime.
Yet this world is made for our rectification.
Yes.
And so how does that rectification come about if we are not able to connect our present experience with our past behavior?
That's why Krishna comes to tell us. Right? This is why he gives us the Gita. This is why he gives the association of devotees. So if we want to learn the connection, we can. But it's something that has to be learned. It's not something that's conditioning that we're going to get automatically. It is learned. We have to be able to actually put some effort to learn it. He's not going to just do it like this, because then that would give us no free will. But he gives us plenty of opportunities. He sends his devotees, he comes himself down every few hundred years, he gives us Bhagavad Gita, so many scriptures, he gives us the deity form, he gives us the holy name, he gives us religions in every part of the world. Krishna does a lot to help remind us. He does a lot. But he still gives us some space to be rebellious. He gives us some room to do what we want. He's the perfect parent, teaching us and at the same time giving us space to learn. So we'll stop here. It's 4:00. Thank you all for your attention. The first verse is in some ways the most important, because without understanding it, you can't actually do anything else that's listed in the other three verses. But we will continue after a break at 5:00. The primary session, like I said, will be a workshop where we'll get a chance to work with the Bhagavad Gita ourselves and use our knowledge of the Gita to try to understand its essence. We have some nice process here. So do come for that. It's a workshop. And then we will continue after that and also tomorrow, talking about the remaining three verses. Tomorrow we have one more session about this. Okay? Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.